Hello?
Hello, Beverly. Do you like coffee?
Yeah, I love coffee.
What's your favorite coffee?
Well, that's Sparkplug coffee, of
Of
course.
course!
Because Sparkplug always starts with premium Arabica beans that are always fair trade. They offer a variety of blends and roasts, including a rotating blend, so your next new favorite is always around the corner. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this coffee to you in Canada or the US within just 1 week of custom roasting it so that when it reaches you, it's always fresh and at its peak flavor, and you will taste the difference.
I like delicious coffee.
You can order Sparkplug a la carte, or you can take the thinking out of it and just join the Autopilot Coffee Club for scheduled deliveries. It's flexible and customizable, it's got all the convenience with none of the commitment. And because you listened to the Top 100 Project, Sparkplug is going to give you 20% off your next coffee order. Just use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, and that's all one word with the number 100. Life is short. Drink better coffee. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
That coffee doesn't sound scary at all. I guess I won't gut you like a fucking fish.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action!
Hey, buddies, and thanks for taking part in the 411th Ellis's Analysis. Every Monday morning, we parcel out our thoughts about classic films, and in the process, we completely spoil those classic films. What got us going in the podcasting game was reviewing the entire group of 123 moving pictures on the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists. Scroll back to discover our chats about so many outstanding titles. I'm the movie-obsessed over-actor whose mom and dad are going to be so mad at me! Ryan Ellis. And here's the lady who was somewhat abandoned by her mother and has been known to succumb to peer pressure. Although I don't believe she's a mer-diddly erdler. My wife, Bev.
That's me.
The coming attractions trivia question for this week's picture, Scream. Simple title. Last week's movie had a simple title, too. That was Dracula. And it was nominated, Dracula was, for three AFI lists, and it made them all. How many lists did Scream make?
I think it made none.
Correct.
It was nominated for a few, never made the cut.
What made me think of this question? It's because it's the exact same three that Dracula made. It was nominated for the Top 100 Thrills, the Top 50 Villains, and the Top 100 Quotes. Dracula made all three of those, Scream didn't do any of them, and Scream probably could have ranked on all three of those lists as much as or more than Dracula.
I'm going to give myself away here for this podcast and also for anybody who hasn't listened to our Dracula podcast yet, but Scream is a better movie.
Well, in almost every way. Hard to say Dracula doesn't belong somewhere on the villains list, if nothing else to represent the entire lexicon of Dracula's.
As I said then, I guess you just had to be there. But maybe if you were there, it really was that outrageous and radical and influential. Just hard to watch now, as opposed to this movie, which has aged like a fine wine, in my opinion.
And it wasn't that great a thrill. We weren't scared by it. Scream isn't really scary anymore, but it was the first time I saw it, and maybe even the second, with an incredible opening. We'll talk about that in a few seconds. And Killer is pretty iconic, too. Obviously more modern. 25 years ago. Can you believe that? This movie's 25 years old. Also, one more thing before we move on. Those same three categories, Marathon Man made those too. The thrills, the villains, and the quotes.
Huh.
And that was back in August. We covered that movie. Okay, Wes Craven's Scary Movie. The original title of this movie was Scary Movie. And that is a better title because I actually say that many times in the film. Scream's good. Scary Movie's better. And of course, then a parody series came out of that. The Wayans brothers did that. Very successful. At least the first couple were. It was released in the Christmas season by Miramax 25 years ago on December 20th, 1996. The budget was quite small, so the $173 million it hauled in worldwide made it a huge success. Programming a movie like this at Christmas time against the prestige pictures obviously worked.
Teenagers don't want to go see The English Patient.
Which was probably at December Christmas season, I guess, yeah.
Yeah.
That was the best picture winner, by the way. That was the year the independent films that were at the Oscars, mostly in the big categories. This wasn't, but it was a pretty good success, and look at us talking about it now. And we didn't talk about English Patient this year, and we won't, as the year's almost over. Or coming close anyway. Okay, so we're now in Scary Movie Month. We did a couple other quote-unquote scary movies, Dr. Sleep and Dracula. But here's one that might be considered zeitgeisty even now. Maybe for one reason, because they're doing another version of this. I don't know if it's a reboot or another sequel next year. Anyway, Scream's been done many times, a lot of sequels, a lot of spin-offs. But please give us the skinny on the original one right now, please, Bev.
Nev Campbell is Sydney, high school senior, about to observe the anniversary of her mom's grisly murder when two of her classmates get brutally stabbed to death. The town closes ranks and everyone's a suspect, including Sydney's boyfriend Billy, who really doesn't do himself any favors with his serial killer glower thing he has going on. The body count climbs, and when a party Sydney attends with her friends turns into a total bloodbath, she is forced to take out the killers herself with some help from an entertainment reporter.
Courtney Cox becomes a hero. You said celebrate the anniversary or observe. What was it?
About I said
the
observe. I didn't observe. Say celebrate.
Even observing.
We were at the hardware store today and you saw sparklers and you're like, what's this for? Well, I don't know. Maybe someone's celebrating the anniversary of their mother's death.
Even observing would be worthy of sparklers, I guess. Or in a nutshell, thanks to Shaggy and the guy who looks like Johnny Depp, the vice principal is getting promoted. Missing the point of Scream entirely with that line. But he is, or she is, getting promoted because the Fonz, he did. Chris and I talked about him when we did The Waterboy not that long ago on Scoring at the Movies. That around this time, and this is maybe the start of it all, really, in a way, Henry Winkler became cool again after being so cool about 20 years before in Happy Days. Known for a comedy TV show, and of course got it back on TV in a couple of great series since, Arrested Development, and now Barry. But he plays it so weird in this movie. He's so aggressive with the kids, which is one of the many, very smartly done by Kevin Williamson and Wes Craven, Williamson the writer, Craven the director, red herrings. You wonder for a little while, at least, is he maybe the killer? Until he's just completely offed by either Billy or Stu. Okay, the numbers on Scream. The Rotten Tomatoes critics, 79% of them are in favor. 7.2 out of 10 was the average. 75 reviews are on there, so that's a pretty good sample. And 79% of audiences also, so 79 and 79. As for those three sequels and the TV show, which I've never watched, I don't know anything about it. I don't know if Campbell's involved, and I'm sure Craven wasn't. Of course, Craven's been dead for quite a few years now. But Scream 2, 81%, even stronger than the first one.
Wow.
It does follow it up quite nicely, and just like this one, is very self-aware, but in that case, of sequels. Scream 3, 40% of critics, and it deserved less than that probably even. It's not very good. They had really tapped the well a little at that point. And Scream 4, back up to a fresh tomato, but just barely 60%.
Which I remember liking just fine, but it really is one of those franchises that's never captured the lightning in a bottle quite like the original.
So the movie in 1996 was 13th at the box office. Independence Day, which we covered a few months ago, was number one, far and away. Jerry Maguire, which Chris and I covered for Scoring at the Movies years ago, was number four. And Fargo, which you and I covered for the Top 100 Project many years ago, and a great film, probably the best of that year, actually, was 67th. We talked about the three AFI lists, the thrills, the quotes. The quote was, of course, do you like scary... Hold on. Do you like scary movies? Roger Jackson, he, of course, is the voice on the phone in all of the movies. He kept on doing that job. And then Ghostface, of course, was nominated for the Top 50 Villains. And that's many people. And I'm not sure about the series, like I said. It's always been somebody in some way who's related or has something to do with Sydney. So her boyfriend and his best friend in this movie. The second one, it's her, okay, spoiler alert now, but Billy's mother and a classmate of hers. That's Timothy Oliphant. And Laurie Metcalf is the mother. The third one is her half-brother, right? Yeah. So her mother, who they make pretty clear as the series goes on.
Kind of like Halloween.
Got around. She had a son with somebody else. And then four, I forget, but I think maybe the killer is a stepsister.
Sister, cousin something like or something.
A kid she didn't know was in her family, something like that. But they're always in some way affecting Sydney. How this woman is even walking the streets and not in a home is beyond me. The film got no Oscar nominations, but it did win some Saturn Awards, including for the movie itself. Campbell's performance and Williamson's screenplay also won some Fangorias. So we saw this movie a week ago. Not so fresh in our minds, but I've seen it many times. I know it pretty well. What did you think of it this time?
I haven't seen it in a long time, and I loved it. I think it's a nearly perfect movie.
Really?
I get that it's kind of dumb, but it very much knows it's dumb. It's smart about the ways that it's dumb. No, you're right. It's not dumb. It's silly sometimes. That's not the same as being dumb. I can't believe, when I was doing my research, how, in general, the reviews aren't more positive. I really assumed that this was a total classic now, but there really isn't that much out there talking about the impact, analyzing what it did that was so fresh and new and different and what it did that was so great. And maybe I'm just in that Gen X sweet spot to fully appreciate all the sarcasm and the irony that is this movie's entire ethos, the ethos of Gen X.
Height of irony, mid-90s.
Right, exactly. So it could just be that this film appeals really specifically to me, but it also is just supremely watchable and fun, and that script is tight as a drum.
This was Kevin Williamson's first screenplay. What a start. He did write Scream 2 and Scream 4. I think it was Aaron Kruger who wrote the third one. And of course, he also is pretty well known for Dawson's Creek. He's only written 7 screenplays in total. What a debut for somebody who was a huge Halloween fan, but also a big Wes Craven fan. Craven wasn't the first choice to direct. Not that Williamson had any kind of say about that anyway. But I'm guessing that Williamson would have loved it to be John Carpenter because of the Halloween connection. But there's also some Nightmare on Elm Street connections, and we've covered that before a couple years ago. One of Wes Craven's many horror classics. We talked about this on one of our horror movies either last year or the year before. Who's the greatest horror movie director of all time? Partly for body of work, because what's the greatest horror movie? If that's, say, let's say somebody says The Exorcist. You wouldn't. I probably wouldn't either. But then you'd have to say William Friedkin. Well, he doesn't really have any other horror movies that stand out, if any at all. Well, he has a few others.
I would say The Shining, but Kubrick. He only directed one horror film.
Right. So if you go by body of work, Wes Craven is certainly on the shortlist because he did the 70s slasher movies, those more down and dirty, is this real kind of films, Last House on the Left, Hills Have Eyes. Then he does A Nightmare on Elm Street, which for all of its failures is one of the most creative ideas anyone's ever had for any movie, but especially for a horror film. And then along comes this movie. So it gives a guy who was floundering a little bit. Craven was trying to get away from horror. He did do that movie with Meryl Streep in, I think, 99, but he did the sequel and the other sequel, so 2 and 3, back to back, and eventually did 4. So he mostly did horror at this point. Maybe he realized, hey, it's just my genre. I tried a movie with Meryl Streep, and she got nominated for yet another Oscar, but Music of the Heart, did you even know that title until I said it right now?
No, I was waiting. I was like, there you go. Is he going to tell me what movie it is? Because I don't know.
Eddie Murphy was still most at the height of his career when they did Vampire in Brooklyn. Nobody really saw that, as I recall, either, although that was horror. But this movie also has that weird combination, weird at the time, maybe not so much now, of humor and horror. And as you said, this is actually more of a mystery than a horror film as well.
Plot-wise, it's way more of a mystery. You look at Halloween, it's not a mystery. They know who the killer is. They just have to get away from him, and he systematically...
Well, they don't really. We do, as the audience. And the very first time you see the movie, you don't even know really, well, you know literally who he is, but you don't know why he's doing this.
It's a psychiatrist chasing people around, trying to warn everybody about him. As long as the audience knows who the killer is, then it's not a mystery to the audience. Whereas Scream, it's a really well-written mystery, too. It really draws out certain red herrings, but none of them are too overly stupid. I hate a clumsy red herring that insults the audience's intelligence. In this, it was could have been anybody for so long before you finally start to hone in, and there's those great touches like when both Stu and Randy are running up to the house at the same time, like, he's the killer! No, he's the killer! Mm-hmm. I remember my brain exploding when I saw that in the theater for the first time. That moment's so cool.
And at that point, who made more sense? Probably the movie geek.
Absolutely.
Who also, many times in this movie, Jamie Kennedy plays it weirder than he probably should. Maybe smartly on the part of Williamson, Craven, and Kennedy, though. The scene where we first really get to know him and Stu and Billy, Matthew Lillard and Skeet Ulrich, and Rose McGowan, we've already met her briefly earlier in the day at school. But the five of them, including, of course, Sydney, are all sitting around. Randy is probably the weirdest in some ways of the five of them. And then the video store sequence. They should watch Prom Night, they'll save time. So he's overdoing it, but in a good way. Jamie Kennedy often overdid it anyway. But I'm watching that scene more closely this time. Matthew Lillard as Stu says enough things, and the way that Skeet Ulrich, as Billy, is looking at him. Stop it, you're going to give us away, you idiot, because it's supposed to be the night before when they kill Casey and her boyfriend, Steve. And it's been confirmed by Williamson, because I wondered about this question when I was preparing today, who actually is the one? They're both guilty. They both go to jail if they were just found guilty of that one murder.
If they'd lived.
If they'd lived, yes. But of the Casey and Steve murders. But who actually killed Casey? It only really makes sense if it's her ex-boyfriend, mm-hmm. Stu, who the very next day is talking about this like he's uninvolved, which is one thing. Okay, fine. But he slaughtered somebody who he once maybe loved, or at least liked. Just how psychotic is this guy? But the most key part of that scene is Billy's not giving it away. Skeet Ulrich is not the greatest actor of all time, but I love the way he played that. Just Slate looks like, just shut up, man. We want to enjoy this, but you're enjoying it too much. And of course, Matthew Lillard, as much fun as he is in this movie, and some of the biggest laughs, really overplays it.
Yeah, his whole performance is overkill, especially in the third act. Oh my god, he really takes it too far. I think actually one of the faults in the movie is maybe they gave the actors a little too much room to really eat the scenery. But back to this idea of red herrings, when you watch it a second time and you see Casey's murder, and then the very next scene, you see Billy climbing into her bedroom window for what we learn is the first time he's ever done that. And he's just all hot and bothered, right? And it just seems like this cute scene between these two teenage
lovebirds.
But then you realize the second time you watch the movie, oh my god, he's turned on because he just slaughtered two people. It's not his first murder, but he's clearly a serial killer who spent a whole year planning out this series of murders that he wanted to commit with his buddy. But we learn later that he killed her mother about a year prior because his mother was having an affair with his father. Also because maybe he's just a psycho killer.
Mm.
They talk a lot about motives in this movie, that they really want to get to the bottom of why would you do this? It's maternal abandonment, it's this and that. But then the great response to that when she asks Stu, well, why did you do it?
Peer pressure.
Peer pressure. What a great joke. And also, give me a break. Your mother abandoned you. If everybody whose mother abandoned them became a murderer, there wouldn't be a human being left on planet Earth. It's an absurd response to that.
Well, look at Stu's house. Now, money's not everything, but Stu lives in a mansion. About a third of the movie, by the way, is set at Stu's house for the party at the end. This is a good screenplay, as you said, maybe even a very good screenplay. But one of the things you definitely have to question is, there's a strict curfew. Kids have to be home by, whatever, 7 o'clock or dusk, wherever it is.
Have to be in somebody's home.
Why can any of them go to this party? And then when David Arquette goes through the party as the cop, as Dewey, don't drink. Okay, drink. Have a good time. Part of the problem with him, and this is also a deliberate touch, it's not really a problem, but his character is somebody who wants to be cool and liked because he's still so young, so boyishly good looking, but also is a cop. He'd be a killjoy to shut down the drinking of underage kids, but he probably should. But bigger than that is, why are they out of their own parents' house the very first day they've been given a curfew? Why are you out at all? Because you're going to have to go home at some point. And then they all take off, a lot of them at least. Great way to get rid of them as well from the party, to go fuck with Hembree's corpse because he's been gutted and hung from the goalpost. Let's go screw with them. It's such a small part of the movie, and it doesn't really matter that much because you got to get rid of those kids is really what it comes down to. Yeah. Billy and Stu can't kill everybody. But how sick are they that that's their first thought? Let's go fuck with our principal's corpse. Wow.
And I get that he was kind of a hard-ass principal, but yeah, they're probably just kids that want to go see it for themselves and the morbid curiosity. But you're right, it's just an excuse to get them all out of the house.
Because it's the first night.
Characters are the only ones that are left to get slaughtered.
And because it's the first night of the curfew, the sheriff should be out patrolling the streets, which really Dewey should be doing more so, but he's at a party with a lot of these kids, so maybe he's doing his job in that way. But the sheriff is probably driving around. He's probably going to see them and then at least send them home, if not do something else. Maybe, I don't know, can he charge kids for defying the curfew? Probably not.
Dewey, did he protect anybody, really? Because other than the fact that he provided the weapon, Gail, I think, is the one ultimately...
Gail's the one who shoots.
And then Sidney shoots him...
Finishes him off,
with a bullet to the head. But other than being the one to bring that gun into the house before he was knocked unconscious like a damsel...
Hmm. Well, he was supposed to die, but test audiences liked David Arquette so much. He was still fairly new to movies. I recently watched Buffy the Vampire Slayer again, the movie, recently. It's not very good. It's certainly not scary. But he was becoming a bit of a name. And of course, his sisters had been names long before, Patricia and especially Rosanna. I think she was actually the one that became a name first of all of them. But the test audiences liked him so much they didn't want him to die. So even though he clearly is dead on the front porch, including when Courtney Cox falls on him when she gets knocked out, he's not breathing because he was told to play that way by Craven. You're dead. But then they reshot stuff. And he's in all of the sequels. He's supposed to be in the next movie with Campbell and Cox. Maybe other ones from the series are, but I'm not even sure who's even alive anymore. But they're the three main characters who've lived through all of this.
I think everybody else has bitten the dust at some point. I guess this must have been in the third movie, because Randy dies, and he's a character that should have survived. The second movie, he dies. And it's a shame, because he really belongs in the movie, and they shouldn't have killed him off. But then they bring him back. He taped himself, telling everybody what to expect.
That's how
the
he's
third
in three,
film.
Yep.
Give me a break. That's a weak plot device at the best of times, but the notion that he was like, I know I'm gonna die and I'm gonna give you instructions of how to survive the third if you want to kill him off, you kill him off. That
which
was
is part
dumb.
Of why three's not very good.
Right So Williamson wrote the script. We talked about how this was his first screenplay that ever got made. He had worked on Dawson's Creek, and he was trying to get Teaching Mrs. Tingle made. And
it was then called Killing Mrs. Tingle. Columbine changed that.
Anybody who either has not a great memory or was born after 1985 is going to have no idea what I'm talking about, but it's a horror film that came out in the late 90s. and he was trying to get that made before Scream came out, and it was in development hell. Like a lot of writers, he just locked himself in a room for a couple of weeks, and he cranked out Scream with strictly the intention of making money. He's like, I'm just going to write a movie that is marketable. Obviously, there's a lot of passion put into this. He's a horror movie fan. He was writing the script of the movie that he wanted to see. So he wanted this blend of comedy and horror.
He was doing what Tarantino did.
Something. Yeah, yeah. The 90s was a time of self-referential movies. Scream was not the first one to do it. It wasn't even the first Wes Craven movie to do it.
New Nightmare.
Because New Nightmare came out in 94, which is a movie... Okay, I only have seen parts of it. The cast and crew of Nightmare on Elm Street are playing themselves, right?
Freddy is a demon spirit ghost, in a way, in the movie. Robert Englund is in the movie as Robert Englund.
Who is the actor who
Heather
plays
Heather Langenkamp
Freddy.
Is in the movie as Heather Langenkamp. Yeah. She's always just Heather. She's never actually Nancy. She has a son in the movie and a husband, which I think she did in reality, but I believe they're both actors that play the husband and the son. And Freddy the demon comes after her kid. If I can't get you Nancy, I'll get your kid. But she's not Nancy. She's an actress. Wes Craven at one point appears as Wes Craven, and we see the screenplay with the dialogue that they're currently reading at one point. That's when it gets extremely meta. So you're right, Wes Craven had done that before. And New Nightmare was not any kind of big success, but to a lot of horror fans, it's one of, if not the best, of the Nightmare films. Now, you can't really say it's the best if you don't really incorporate the fact that there wouldn't be that one if there weren't the other ones, especially the first one.
When you're determining the best, you're just saying what is the best individual film. They'll exist in a universe with one another.
But that was, I believe, 94.
Yeah, 94.
And this is 2 years later, he's doing this movie. This one's more famous, but yeah, that set the table for this.
It's just a better movie. It wasn't the 10th sequel to a franchise that at that point was pretty played out. Slasher films were huge in the 80s. Starting with Halloween, up until the end of the 80s, it was the dominant form of horror film. They were super popular, but people saw teenagers at
summer camps.
There's
only so many teenagers you can kill.
Exactly. It was just starting to rehash itself and repeat itself, and people got sick of it, and then this was kind of the thing that replaced it, because there was a lot of films like Scream that followed, like Teaching Mrs. Tingle is a great example. The Faculty, Final Destination, Disturbing Behavior, I Know What You Did Last Summer, probably the most...
None of these are good.
But they really did follow in Scream's footsteps. Scream was the one that opened the door for this next level. And in this version, you get killers that are mostly... I mean, they're supernatural stuff. Faculty is a supernatural film. And Disturbing Behavior is too, actually, all those high school films. But you often get these killers who are real people, in a sense.
Generally, it could happen. Yeah, Scream could happen.
Mike Myers is a real person, but he's invincible.
Don't call him Mike. He'll kill you.
Sorry. Michael Myers is a killer who is human, but really invincible. I mean, Freddy obviously is supernatural. Jason is supposed to be human, but survives drowning. He comes back
many
from the
times
dead,
he survives
over
drowning.
And over.
It's funny, actually, about Jason, because that's the one that doesn't get referenced when people talk about Kevin Williamson's influences. Of course, it's Nightmare on Elm Street because Craven, at least partly, and generally, but especially because of Craven, and Halloween because he's a big fan of that movie in general. But we talked a few minutes ago about how this is a mystery as much as it's a horror film, especially after seeing it so many times. I'm not scared by it at all. Or really even all that tense, except the opening. We haven't even talked about the opening. We got to talk about that
scene. Oh, yeah, I know.
Maybe the best part of the whole film.
It is.
But the only mystery, when you go by the first movies as to who the villain is the first Friday the 13th, which is referenced in this movie. Actually, that's right. This is referenced. And that's the whole point of, you got it wrong. We're going to kill your boyfriend. They would have killed him anyway.
Oh, yeah,
it's an excuse. They would have kept quizzing her until she got something wrong. Although I do love that, well, actually, moment that I think it's Billy that's on the phone, probably, logically, right? And Stu's the one that's doing all the physical menacing. Maybe they both are wearing the black cape and gown and all that stuff and the mask, but Stu's the one I think is doing most of the action. And certainly, I think it only makes sense if he's the one that kills Casey, because she does pull his mask off and she sees a face. And if that was Billy, that would be bad, but it's way worse if it's your ex-boyfriend.
That's why they picked her as a victim, obviously. So he would be the one to pull the triggers.
If I'm going to help you, Billy, you got to help me get revenge on the stupid bitch that dumped me.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, yes, the only one of the big three, Freddy, Jason, and Michael, in their first movie where it's a mystery as to who's doing it, is Friday the 13th. And it's not even Jason in the very first movie, as Drew Barrymore learns in this. Now, the opening of this movie, wow, one of the great openings in any movie. And when I saw it the very first time, I didn't believe that Drew Barrymore was really dead. First, I thought that was a prop knife. And of course, it really is a prop knife that they use on set. But I thought it was some kind of gag within the movie, because I knew about how this was a self-referential meta film. I don't know if they even called it meta back in 1996. But I knew about all those things. So I thought maybe she's in on it or something's going on that she's not dead. Even when she's hanging from the tree with her entrails out, I thought, no, that's got to be fake. And I was stuck on that for a few minutes when the next few scenes played out. Because you're going to kill Drew Barrymore, which of course was the point. It's that Janet Leigh in Psycho thing, although this is even sooner. Janet Leigh lasts until about the 50-minute mark of Psycho. Drew Barrymore, the biggest name in this cast then, and maybe even still now, dies in the first 10, 15 minutes.
And for the record, they did cast her to play Sydney. Yep. And then some scheduling conflicts, blah, 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 came up. They thought of the great idea to just put her in this opening scene. What a brilliant move. I know they weren't the first to do it, but they are one of the best to do stunt casting for a small part off the top that surprises people. I unfortunately had it spoiled for me. Somebody told me. So I knew going into the theater that she was going to die, but I can totally see how you would be like, this is so unconventional.
There's no way it's real.
That there's no way it's real.
And even seeing it now, I've seen the movie five, maybe even six times. Craven shows why he's one of the great horror directors of all time. Building it up, showing the popcorn first being put on the stove to the point where she hasn't tended it, so it's burning.
Anybody who's ever made Jiffy Pop probably has a healthy fear of letting it catch fire in the stove. That's the big threat with Jiffy Pop. Probably part of the reason why you can't really find it anymore is because you can really easily start a fire with it. And she just leaves it on the stove. And so on top of everything else she's going through, I'm like, just turn the stove off! What a great device just to add tension. That's just one of the many things he does to put you at the absolute edge of your seat, no matter how many times you have seen that scene. If you aren't into it, if you aren't thrilled by that scene, then you're not human.
If you were watching this movie the first time, or maybe any time, in a house that's even somewhat remote, with glass windows, all that kind of thing, even if all the blinds are drawn, but especially if they're not, like this house, pretty big house, most of these kids are doing really well. Sydney's house is nice and big. Obviously Stu's is, and so is Casey's. But one of the great lines, because do you like scary movies being a quote? Good. Maybe should have made the list. Very good quote. Important. Although people don't really quote it. And they don't quote this either, but it might be the key moment in the whole scene, which is, I want to know who I'm looking at. The music cue as well.
It's like their version of the calls coming from inside the house. Like, it's almost literally
that's a good comparison.
Exact same device.
Yeah, you're right. That's a good comparison. Because once, again, I think it's Billy on the phone, says that, that's when her demeanor changes, because it's a little flirty, a little fun. She thinks it's a crank caller, the guy had the wrong number, all that stuff.
She lies fun with him. She says right. She doesn't have a boyfriend.
Yeah.
Which could give you more cause for why Stu maybe wants to kill her, because she's obviously not that loyal to her boyfriend.
Even this guy, let alone him, when he was her boyfriend. And apparently what Wes Craven did to get Drew Barrymore really into the mood of this, to be scared, terrified, crying, is to be off camera talking about dog torture. Because Drew Barrymore, much like you, is such a big animal person, big dog person.
No!
So I'm always picturing, whenever I see the scene where she's crouching by the TV and weeping, that over there on the side is Wes saying, the dog got run over today, or something like that. Or somebody wore a fur coat to set. I won't tell you who.
No! I'd be like, you need to cast someone else for this role, Wes.
We talked about the red herrings, though. So in that moment, you wouldn't have any idea who it would be and why it would be them. But let's talk about the sheriff, because he has his shoes, is one of them. Billy, obviously, and this is one of the smarter things about Williamson and Craven. Well, Williamson wrote it, but their work, because Billy acts that way. Skeet Ulrich has a Johnny Depp quality, the look of him to some degree. He's not as good looking as Johnny Depp was at that same time frame. And of course, that was Depp's first movie, Craven's A Nightmare on Elm Street.
Which is intentional that they cast Ulrich, yes, somebody who, right, looks like him.
And Ulrich plays it in many scenes as if he is a killer. He also has those same boots on at one point, and a phone drops when he comes over to Sydney's the second time, and that's why he's arrested. But then, how could he possibly be the killer if the killer called Sydney at the deputy's house when Billy's in jail? And I don't think I thought of this when I saw the movie the first time. There's two of them. And that was one of the great innovations in this movie. Maybe that had been done in other mystery killer-type movies before, but that he's got a partner. And I think, if not all, then certainly the second one had the partner thing, because it's Billy's mother. And it's Sydney's classmate, friend, whatever, Roman, Oliphant's character. But that was one of the great ideas, that it's the two of them. And you start wondering, okay, so when did who do what? Billy and Stu under that mask and the cape and all that kind of thing. Stu is taller, but I watched and listened, more importantly, very carefully to all the attack scenes. And you can literally hear, this is probably deliberate on a Craven's part, when it is Skeet Ulrich or Matthew Lillard grunting or groaning when they're being hit in the balls or had beer bottles thrown at them, punched, knocked down, whatever. I think it's supposed to be Billy in the garage with Tatum. And Tatum is holding her own against him. If she had just kept throwing things at him like beer bottles and not try to run away and then scoot through that dog door, which is how he kills her so famously, she might have beaten him. She was holding her own quite nicely. But it's interesting to hear that these guys must have done the voiceovers for that, because that was probably just a stuntman the whole time. Why ever cast actors underneath those outfits unless you need to reveal their faces?
Yeah, yeah.
And one of the reasons why they have a shot with Neve Campbell taking the gear off is because they wanted to have that as an option too, that maybe she really was the killer. The cheerleader speculates that she's a killer at one point. Why wouldn't she go crazy? Your mother was killed just last year. Maybe she went nuts. So she's one of the red herrings. And then Billy's a red herring, but he actually is involved, but they make it look like he's just a red herring. Randy, to some degree, because of the way he acts so often and he knows so much about horror films.
It would be such a believable twist at the end of a horror movie that the one who's obsessed with horror movies would be the killer. It would be almost cliche to make Randy the killer, but it's written just well enough, with just enough hints and just enough culpable deniability. Like I said earlier, they just don't ever overdo it and ruin it by treating us like idiots. They don't go in too hard with any of the clues. They let us figure it out for ourselves here and there.
They suggest Himbry, but that's just brief because Winkler plays us over the top
that
and so mean.
That scene was only put in there because somebody pointed out that there's
had been a kill in a long time.
Yeah, there's like a 50-minute stretch where nobody dies. Okay, we need an action scene, we need a murder, we need some gore in the middle. Also, it conveniently gives the kids an opportunity to leave the party. They could write it in. And then I guess they cast Winkler afterwards to do the stunt casting as well. And I agree with you. It's fun to see him, but I don't know if he's great casting to play a mean principal, because it's pretty hard to feel like anybody, even a teenager, would be intimidated by him.
Oh, I like the idea of you go against type for that role, especially since he's in the movie so little.
Do you think he pulls it off?
I think it's fine.
Yeah.
He's probably actually better in The Waterboy, where he's able to be funny. And, of course, so great in Arrested Development. But I've already read about all that.
Yeah. And Barry.
And so good in Barry, yeah.
Incredible.
But he's a red herring. The sheriff's a red herring. Even Dewey is. The scene that's also in the trailer with the flashlight under the face to Gale. You're not scared, are you? And David Arquette's always been a bit of a weird actor, so he can really pull off the weirdness factor that he really could be somebody who's a stalking killer. Also, it's really smart that when it would have to be Stu, call Sydney at Dewey's house, and Tatum's house for that matter, too. He's in his room. The phone call comes. She talks to Stu, obviously. Oh, my God, Dewey, get out of here. And as soon as, right around the time, at least, that the phone is hung up is when he bursts out of his room with a gun in his hand, which is kind of stupid in the first place, but he's a bit of a moron. He could have been on the phone.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And, of course, the father is the other big red herring.
Oh, right.
But here's definitely something that I really picked up on. Maybe somebody's addressed this because the movie is 25 years old. They could have talked about this a long time ago. But they say at one point that all the calls came from Neil's phone. And then the boys talk about how they got his phone. But the first night they killed anybody, well, at least in this time frame, because they killed Maureen the year before, Neil was still home because Sydney's in her room. He knocks on the door, but Billy's come into the room and he's hiding. But they've just killed Casey, supposedly with his phone. So that doesn't really make sense. They talked about how you couldn't clone cell phones back then. Maybe you can now. You probably can now. Some egghead probably figured out how to do it.
It's called spoofing. It's very easy to do.
There you go. I thought maybe you could. I'm 47. Just showed it. But anyway, so many red herrings in the end. And I watched this movie with a friend. It's definitely a great whisper movie. I definitely didn't guess it. And especially once Billy gets killed. Well, he can't be the killer, but he's not killed because it's corn syrup. Just like they used in Psycho. Or no, Carrie says it's Carrie.
Right.
Which I think is true that they did use corn syrup for dumping on Sissy Spacek.
Even when the mystery is solved, Scream is still such a fun movie. Almost more fun to watch because you're not concentrating on trying to figure out who done it. You're just enjoying it for what it is, which is a great action movie with some... Now, I know it was censored, but the gore is not messing around.
There's a lot of blood in this.
They had to cut a lot to keep it from being an NC-17 rating, but they earned their R. It is a hard R. The violence perfectly toes the line between being real enough to titillate is the wrong word. It's exciting, right? Violence in film can 100% be exciting to watch, but it also is still always fun. It's scary, but the fun kind of scary.
Yeah. Well, this isn't the first time that the killer in a horror film was another teenager killing teenagers, but it was an interesting touch because, okay, you think it's Billy, but then it can't be if he's in jail. But even if you thought, okay, he's got a partner, why would you think it's Stu necessarily? Because Stu plays it weird and annoying and everything. You think it's Randy, if anything.
And Stu is just this fun party guy. He's the last person in the world you would suspect. He just doesn't seem sinister enough to pull it off. I never really found him that believable as a killer. And it's funny, because he has the best success story. He was a total nobody. He happened to follow his girlfriend to an audition that was in the same building as the auditions for Scream. Ah. And he started talking to one of the casting directors or producers or something and charmed them. And they were like, hey, why don't you come read for this film? And then he got cast in the part and the rest is history. And we all know his name now. I like him as an actor. When he's cast right, he is perfect. And of
three course, times this year, I've covered him in podcasts.
Well, we talked about The Descendants.
The Descendants, he's in that. But he's also in a small role, Without Limits, that Chris and I did a few months ago for Scoring at the Movies.
How old is Without Limits?
1998. But he's playing a college student, so it makes sense.
And, of course, the best casting Shaggy. In Hollywood history is casting him. So Shaggy and Scooby-Doo.
If you really had to rank that for who's the best cast of a previous property, really, right? Because you can't really say the best casting for some original character. I wouldn't think it'd be the same kind of game we're playing here. But some pre-existing property of a movie, a TV show, a character, comic book, novel, whatever it is, who's the best ever? Matthew Lillard is somewhere in that conversation, definitely, for playing Shaggy.
Oh, yeah. I've seen him be cast poorly, but I really like him in The Descendants. I'm sure we talked about this. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of his best performances.
One scene.
Well, he has more than one scene, technically, but...
One major scene. One
yeah,
scene
one
matters.
Major scene. The vulnerability he expresses in that movie is great. It's such a nuanced performance, and it's really a grown-up performance from somebody that I forever think of as a teenager.
I thought that movie was going to be funnier than it was this time. It was never a laugh-out-loud comedy constantly anyway, but I don't know if we laughed all that much at that one. And I thought I was going to laugh more at this one, too. Maybe because I've seen it so many times, I didn't really laugh that much. Just like I wasn't really that scared. But this is many viewings in, so I'm not criticizing this movie for it. But he does have the best laugh in the whole movie. And I did it before. It's the, my mom and dad are going to be so mad at me.
Oh, my God.
Also, when Billy throws the phone at him, he didn't mean to, but it stuck in his hand because of the fake blood, I guess. And then it came out of his hand when he didn't mean for it to actually hit Lillard in the back of the head. He says something like, ow, you dick. That was an improv because of an accident that happened with Ulrich. I would say it's the best part of the movie because he really does overdo it with the tongue out and all that kind of stuff. But it's fun at the end when it's a revelation. And it's one of those, oh, shit moments again with Corey sitting beside me. Oh, man, I didn't see that coming. I'm sure we said something like that. Because when Skeet Ulrich turns around and says, we all go a little mad sometimes, if you could pause the movie for a minute and say, but wait a minute, how could he do all these things? He could do most, if not all of them, with a partner.
Even minutes prior, when you had Randy and Stu running up to the house saying, he's the killer, he's the killer. One of them has to be the killer. They can't both be innocent. That alone makes you think, well, how could Billy be the guy? Because that means they were both innocent. Why does one of them think the other is the killer?
Mm.
But they don't make you wait very long for that second revelation. Maybe they realize the audience is going to start thinking, but this
is dumb. Only about a minute later when you find out what's really going on. We have barely mentioned the star of the movie.
Nev Campbell. God, that's so true. That's not fair because she's quite good.
Yeah, because she was in Party of Five, I think before this, around the same time anyway. As we said before, she's been in all the sequels, and she's going to be in the next one they're doing. Supposedly next year it'll come out, but with the pandemic, who knows, I might get pushback. She's in The Craft with Skeet Ulrich after this, I guess it was? Before this?
Before.
Right, because that's why she agreed to be in this, partly. It was, oh, Skeet's in this, so then maybe I'll work with him again.
She didn't want to do another horror film, because The Craft is a pretty horror-y,
but here's a
movie.
Friend and a colleague and everything. She's only been in 7 movies in the past 10 years. I do remember a critic saying about her, I think it was in 54, a couple years after this, that she's cute, but couldn't act her way out of a paper bag. I wouldn't go that far, but she's fine in this movie. I do really like the way she plays the balls that Casey did. Not that I'm impugning Drew Barrymore's Casey, because she's great, as somebody who breaks down so fast, partly because it's nighttime and she's just wide open. No one's there. But it's interesting that Sydney is the opposite. I'm going to call your bluff. Open the front door. Huh? What am I doing now? Picking my nose. What am I doing here? We already know what's happened, as does she. It's not like she's some babe in the woods. She knows that her classmates and maybe even friends got killed. But she's calling their bluff. She says, I think in that same conversation on the phone with whichever one it is, Billy or Stu. Probably Stu. We'll get to that in a second. I'm not some big-titted blonde going to run upstairs. It's insulting. Which, of course, happens later on. She does run upstairs when she's cornered. And I remember in the trailer when they see the big-titted blonde thing, they show Rose McGowan with her nipples sparking out. Because she is a blonde. And she definitely has big boobs. The reason why I think it's Billy that attacks her is the same reason why it was Stu that attacked Casey. I'm going to kill my current girlfriend. I guess because she's not putting out or because we killed her mother last year and this is part of the thing. But were they really trying to kill her in that moment in her house when they first call her, which is a day or two, something like that, before the big climax of the movie? Because the grand climax they have, you could argue they improvise one. They must have already kidnapped Neil, her father. I don't know where he's been all this time. killing her there would be so anticlimactic. So do you think they were trying? Well, he obviously was. That's one of the things, again, with maybe the screenplay doesn't really truly hold up in every way, because he does stab at her. He could have easily hit her and killed her.
They must have always been planning on killing her. It's his girlfriend, but if he wanted her to survive, they would have done a lot of things differently. So either they consider her disposable if she got in their way, or they always plan on killing her, and they certainly always plan on taunting her and messing with her. And you're right, Billy doesn't have a motive to kill her. She had nothing to do with what her mother did. She was also left without a mother by that whole situation, so...
She was more abandoned than he was by the mother.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's just her
because
and her father.
Her mother's literally dead.
Yeah, it's just him and his father. Well, he has siblings, too, I think. But there's no reason why he would want her dead, other than, of course, he's a psycho killer.
Yeah, that's something we shouldn't forget, that he is truly an insane killer.
Just because. And I agree with you that, yeah, she's not the world's greatest actress. I would say she just doesn't have a lot of range, but when she's playing somebody who's really close to herself, which is contemporary, really close to her own age, and I believe when she's scared and freaked out, she seems really convincingly terrified.
But she can fight back.
Also very convincingly has the chutzpah to fight back and to stand up to them. And the way that Casey, in Drew Barrymore's performance, we talk about how great that scene is. She's also somebody who I don't really consider one of Hollywood's greatest actresses.
No.
But what she does do well, she does extremely well. And the fear that she has in that scene.
Some of the best ever.
It is outstanding. Without her performance, it would never be as good as it was. And it is that vulnerability and that terror that's making her make irrational decisions like running up the stairs when you should be running out of the house or whatever.
The other one of the major three then, Courtney Cox, so it's Campbell and Arquette, they're still alive in this series, and Courtney Cox is too, as Gail Weathers, who went a long way in this series, including falling in love for real with David Arquette and marrying him. One of my favorite touches on Friends, there's a lot of good touches on Friends. It was a good show for a long time. But the season after they got married, which I believe is in the off season, for at least one episode the following year, every one of the cast was Arquette, because it was Courtney Cox Arquette.
I totally forgot about that.
Matthew so Perry funny. Arquette.
That's so funny.
She hasn't really made that many movies. Neither has Skeet Ulrich, for that matter, or Campbell. Arquette hasn't really made a ton of them himself. That's why I say Drew Barrymore might be the most famous person even now from this cast. But Cox and Campbell in Wes Craven's film here, he makes their eyes especially, but their faces in general, pop. They both look beautiful in the close-ups in this movie. And Wes Craven does not mind having great, big, huge close-ups.
I thought you were going to say something else.
I'm thinking about their eyes, literally.
Big-titted blondes.
Well, Rose McGowan will get their... Okay, fine. But no, the two main women, because Campbell and Cox are... Cox is the second most important woman in this movie. She's got the second most screen time of the women and among the most screen time of anybody. Maybe second most of every character, really. When you got tight close-ups on them, my God, their eyes are just blazing off the screen. They both look so great in this. It reminds me of Kevin Smith with Rosario Dawson and Elizabeth Banks into his comedies. Kevin Smith made these two beautiful women look almost better in these movies than other people have in
Maybe
their
it's
movies.
Because he just pairs them with total schlubs.
I don't know what it was, although those two are beautiful anyway. Rose McGowan, she was in Ready to Rumble with David Arquette a couple years later after this movie. Chris and I covered that one, too. Not a good movie. I just mentioned it because she did it with Arquette. And I don't know if it was on this movie. I'm not sure when it happened, but she got Harvey'd. She apparently also got Mansoned, as in Marilyn Manson. She's not the most likable person of all time,
but she's been through a lot. Yeah,
she's lucky to
still be around after all the trauma she's experienced. Yep. She was also brought up in a crazy, terrible cult.
I didn't know that.
Yes, yeah.
What I was going to say, though, was that just based on what we want from her, which is her acting ability and performances in films and so on, I wouldn't say we lost the young Kate Hepburn or Julia Roberts or Viola Davis or somebody like that and her not really making movies, certainly not that level anymore. But we lost somebody who definitely had some talent. She's got good sass in this movie. I already said before, even though she's not big, she's so little, despite the giant boobs, that she made it believable that she's fighting back against, again, it's got to be Billy under the costume. I believe that she probably could have kicked his ass if she kept on fighting back rather than try to get away. Don't try to get away. Kill him. You probably could. Or at least knock him out.
She was like one of the coolest actresses of the 90s. And I remember being in awe of her from this movie that she's so funny and also Jawbreaker, where she's a mean girl, but she's so cool.
Mm-hmm. So, of course, it's awful that Harvey got to her, too. And she says flat out raped her. This isn't one of those he jerked off in a plant or he grabbed her ass. This is, no, he raped me.
He made this movie with her. So,
right.
This is a Miramax film.
Yeah, our next movie as well.
Well, it was really a Dimension film, so it was actually Bob Weinstein, I think, that
Dimension's what paid for a lot of Harvey's movies.
Yeah, yeah. Miramax didn't really make all that much money, but Dimension, which made much more crowd-pleasing box office movies.
All of the Scream films.
All of the Scream films, along with...
Well, some of the chintzy comedies, like I think Can't Hardly Wait was number one for a week or two.
Right.
And Harvey could say to his friends, I got the number one movie at the box office this week. And it's really more Bob.
Bob was the one who made the money, and Harvey was the one that won the Oscars.
Mm-hmm. And got the prestige. So we have to talk about Harvey way too often because he's produced so many good movies, and we're not going to not talk about them just because he's a producer on them. As you said many times, he's not on screen. It makes it a lot easier to deal with. But we don't know if he was even on this movie, but at some point, she says raped her. Goddamn fucking asshole.
It's not like her accusation is hard to believe, so I'll just take her at her word that that's exactly what happened. When people talk about how we should be focusing on the careers that were ruined by villains rather than the villains who are having their career ruined by being held accountable for their villainy, she's a great example of a talent that was taken out of Hollywood in one way or another. Difficult is the wrong word. I think she's just a person who's been traumatized to the point where she can't cope anymore, or she's coping, but in a way that doesn't really make her employable in Hollywood for the most part. That was a talent that we lost because of Harvey Weinstein.
Probably traumatized, but also I'm sure a lot of it was, hey, Steven, don't use her in a movie. She's this or that. Maybe making up bullshit.
What it is. We know that he threw his weight around and ruined actors and actresses' careers.
So when it comes to her career, the rape is bad enough, but then he doubles down on it by squashing her to people. Yeah. One of the scandals here, too, and we can't entirely blame these other people, is why did you listen to him? But then he's such a powerful person, and they probably don't want to deal with bullshit either. And a lot of them could be doing some of the same things. We may find out. Every year, new revelations come about. I think if we really, truly heard about what men in power have done, it'd be so many more than you ever think it is in all walks of life, especially in entertainment and sports and music.
I don't even think it stops there. If you are the biggest fish at the tuna fish plant, then you probably also are getting away with murder in just your own small pond.
Yeah. Okay, well, speaking of sex, but in a good way in this movie, at least at the time, Sydney finally sleeps with Billy, not knowing he's a killer. We don't know he's a killer at that point either.
Playing with the convention that virgins always die.
Right. Randy even says at the end that, I've never been happier to be a virgin.
One of the better jokes in this movie, but you're right. 25 years later, it doesn't crack me up quite the way it did, but it's a good one.
Because he does survive. Dewey wasn't supposed to. It would have been Gail, Sydney, and him. The only ones from that house that would have survived. Kenny dies. W. Earl Brown. We just talked about him recently in Vanilla Sky. He's the bartender that won't look at Tom Cruise when he's getting drunk that night at the bar. Oh, another red herring, by the way. And he's a bigger part of the second movie where he's a much bigger red herring. Liev Schreiber, who has this tiny role as Cotton Weary as the one who supposedly killed Maureen Prescott and went to jail for it. But we learn later was Billy set him up. He was actually having an affair with Maureen Prescott.
I forgot all about him, but he might be the biggest star from this movie now. Maybe him and Drew Barrymore. He has such a small part in this movie, and he's an A-lister now.
Such a key part of our most popular podcast ever, Spotlight.
Believe it or not, our top download.
It's finally having a slower month here in September. We reviewed this movie in September, even though we posted in October. But finally, Spotlight's not just going through the roof like it does almost every single month. I don't know why. I like the movie and the podcast we did of it, but man.
It's outperforming The Dark Knight and...
Godfather.
Yeah, exactly.
Everything. You name it, it's outperforming all of them. Linda Blair's in this too, very briefly as a reporter. So she is, of course, Reagan in The Exorcist. A little bit of stunt casting, that's fun. And then Joseph Whipp, I don't remember who he is, but he is in A Nightmare on Elm Street. And he is the sheriff who does have the shoes, similar to what we saw earlier with the Ghostface Killer, or we learn later, the Killers.
You're missing the biggest stunt casting in the whole film. Wes Craven, playing the janitor, dressed like
Very
Freddy
briefly.
Krueger.
Blink and you miss it kind of cameo, yeah. Oh, one more thing about the plot I want to talk about, at least briefly here. It's probably deliberate on Williamson's part because this movie is meta and it does have some humor, a lot of humor. But the idiots stab each other before finishing off Sydney and her father. They explain what they're going to do, and they need to do that. That makes sense for our benefit. If they're going to kill her, why explain it to her except to taunt her? But like in every movie, they do it for our benefit. But you're doing it before you've killed her? Then stab yourselves, you morons.
Okay, that's dumb. You're right. But they are dumb teenagers. Mm-hmm.
They're smart, but they're not that smart. And then, of course, Sid dies in his own living room with a TV being thrown in his head.
And that's a great irony, too. They were watching a horror movie on that TV.
And the horror movie kills him.
Just shortly before, and then the TV is what takes him out.
More meta, of course, is when Randy is saying, Jamie, behind you, Jamie, he's behind you.
Come on.
And Jamie Kennedy is saying that about himself. And in that moment, I guess it's probably Stu is walking behind him in the Ghostface outfit.
genius. Mm-hmm. Perfection.
I don't think I knew who Jamie Kennedy was at the time, so I didn't get the joke the first time.
I don't know if anybody knew who Jamie Kennedy was. I think this is one of the things that made him a star, isn't it?
Gotta be, yeah.
Yeah.
So when we talk about Jamie Kennedy, we gotta talk about comedy. I still think it's enjoyable and amusing. I'm not going to say it's not funny, but I didn't laugh out loud this time, I don't think. If I did once or twice, maybe. Well, my parents are going to be so mad at me. But apart from that, I didn't really laugh. How about you?
I'm sure I chuckled here and there, but all my favorite jokes in the movie I saw coming a mile away. Yeah, you laugh, you're amused when Lillard does that. And one thing about Lillard's performance is I feel like I noticed how over the top it was more than I did when I was younger. I think it was much more forgiving of his performance back in the day, but now rewatching it, it was almost bordering on cringe. So he's the funniest person in the movie. Him and Rose McGowan are the funniest people in the movie.
She's funny too, it's true.
Yeah, yeah.
We talk so much about her tragic life, but she was a good actress and she can be funny. Clearly in this movie she was.
Yeah. It took away a little bit for me, but still so fun.
Mm-hmm. Watching Scream 2 again a few days ago, by the way, Liev Schreiber could easily have played a great serial killer, horror movie character, whatever. Maybe he hasn't, something I can't think of right now. But
I remember really believing that he could have been the killer. The only reason you're pretty sure he's not the killer is because you're like, they would never give it away this much.
But he had motivation. You put me in jail, you're going to pay for it. I believe in 3, maybe it's 4, but I think it's 3, he dies in the opening.
He definitely dies at some point. Yeah,
he's got
I remember
a girlfriend,
his death scene. Yeah, that's
life.
Right. Everything's going
He's
down,
on the phone, and right? Then whoever it is the killer.
He's the
him.
Opening death. He's the Drew Barrymore of the third movie. That's right.
Hmm. Speaking of Barrymore, by the way, we covered her earlier this year in Donnie Darko, where she's a teacher.
Oh, yeah.
So
right.
One of her kids in this movie would have killed her, or wanted to, probably. Okay, we talked about Craven directing, Williamson writing. Pretty good team. They worked together again on Scream 2 and Scream 4. Craven directed 3, but Williamson wasn't involved by the looks of it anyway.
Even though when he sold the script, he sold it with the outlines for Scream 2 and Scream 3.
Well, it made sense because he's got this ongoing story. Maybe I said they were made back-to-back, 2 and 3, but actually I think it was 2 that was the next year after this, 97, and then 3 was 2000.
That was the model for horror films at the time. These studios made money time after time after time. They made absolute fortunes off these franchises.
The Universal Monsters theory back in the 30s and 40s.
Even to the next level, because there was only a handful of Frankenstein movies versus how many Jason movies were there.
And Saw, about 10 years after this, every single year they made a Saw movie.
It's just a great model.
And they always succeeded. Well, speaking of money and that kind of thing, Kathy Conrad and Kerry Woods were the producers, along with, of course, the Weinsteins as executive producers. The movie's 2:39:1. We saw it on Prime, although we do have the Blu-ray, but if you can watch it on streaming, then why not watch it streaming? Cinematographer Mark Irwin apparently battled with Wes Craven on this, and it did look soft a bunch of times. I was reading it's because it was out of focus, and I felt like I did notice the out of focus thing. And I read the note about it being out of focus after we saw the movie, so I wasn't influenced by that, I don't think. But he did shoot The Dead Zone and The Fly, which we've covered, so Cronenberg films, he worked with him a lot before. As I recall, they look great. And as I said a minute ago, he and Craven made two good-looking women look incredible in this movie, Campbell and Cox. Now he's shooting comedies, though, Irwin is. Got out of the horror genre. The editor, Patrick Lussier, cut Scream 2 and 3 and other Wes Craven movies and other horror films, and now he's directing. So he's had quite a career. And the composer, Marco Beltrami, did music for 2 and 3, Scream 2 and 3. Also The Hurt Locker, which we've covered, Ford vs. Ferrari, which Chris and I covered earlier this year. So many movies, so many compositions. He's done music for many, 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 many movies. I think this is around the time he got started, was the mid-90s. I believe I've read this was his debut. I'm not sure it was his actual debut, but it was one of his first movies.
I read that he tried to make it sound like a Western, and he used Ennio Morricone's scores as inspiration, and Morricone is probably one of my favorite composers.
Did you like this score, then?
I did like this score. A horror movie like this absolutely has to have a score, and it doesn't feel over the top and macabre, and I didn't notice that it was Western. I should go back and like watch some scenes to see if I can catch that style. But this movie doesn't get credit for blending so many genres. You have this Western score with this mystery disguised as a horror film with tons of comedy elements.
Mm.
And a teen movie to boot.
And to make that work. Big time kudos to Craven, Williamson and the cast. And everybody involved, actually. What happens next? Stu's parents move out of that murder house. Their own son died there. Other people died there. They're moving out.
Every therapist in Woodsboro gets a boat.
Yeah, probably true, too. Well, the sequel plays up, I think it's supposed to be 2 years later, even though I think it was 97 that they made it. And Sydney and Randy are in college, and Gail's following them around, so you get her in the movie. And Dewey goes off to make sure she's okay when we see the opening killing, when two people that have nothing to do with anything as far as we know are killed at the Stab premiere. So, of course, the movies get really meta because they make a movie about what happened in the first movie.
And then they cast Tori Spelling to play Sydney, the one actress that she says, oh, my luck, they'll cast Tori Spelling to play me. And that's exactly what they did.
And also Cece is Sarah Michelle Gellar's character in the second one, I think it is. And that was Courtney Cox's nickname for obvious reasons, Cece.
Ah.
Okay, well then, I said before I didn't laugh as much as I have in the past. And it's not really scary because I've seen it so many times. Although some horror films maintain that pretty well. That is a hard thing, actually, to truly maintain if you see a movie many times, the true fright. But it is a pretty good whodunit and mystery, and it's really fun to analyze those moments. Oh, man, and seeing this time, especially Billy, giving the look to Stu. Shut up, man. You're going to give us away. It was last night we fucking killed her. And Steve, for that matter. Stop overdoing this. We want to glory in it, but not this much. Some really good touches. It isn't perfect. No movie's perfect. We point out some of the flaws already. But this is one of the forerunners of meta films, and it's held up pretty damn well. It was definitely enjoyable. Great pace, by the way. I didn't ask you about editing, but I'm assuming you agree with the pace,
the
tension.
You need to ask me. Yeah, I think it's obviously a very well-cut film. I think a lot of what makes it work is in the script, but the editing is impeccable.
And the opening scene could be its own short. You can make that into an Oscar-winning short of fear.
Well, that was the first thing he wrote, was that scene, because there were some murders in his town that inspired this film, and the murders were home invader, and it freaked him right out, because he was at home alone, so he went around locking his doors, and then that just got the gears moving in his head, and so he wrote that scene first, and then the rest of the movie came from there.
And what's fitting is, of course, that it's motivated, they would have killed her anyway, but it's supposedly motivated by her getting a trivia question wrong about horror movies.
Yeah.
So this was our first actual horror movie, because we're now in October when we released this one. Next week, though, we'll be off enjoying turkey and potatoes because October 12th is Thanksgiving here in Canada. And that means we made it! We didn't take any extra weeks off as we get ready to move to our new house. By the time this one goes up, we will have moved, actually. But we are recording this one and next week's episode still in the old place. This house is flawed in many ways, but it was always good from the start for podcasting. Yeah. Mics aside and recording programs aside, because they didn't help us sometimes, but the actual acoustics, pretty good. Anyway, when we talk to you again in 2 weeks, we'll continue with Scary Movie Month as we look at Nicole Kidman and company in the ghost story, The Others. So the coming attraction's trivia, and this is a spoiler alert for those who haven't seen the movie yet. Skip ahead about 10 seconds or so. Name the 10 movies we've already reviewed this year where the main character dies.
For the answer to that question, check out next week's podcast about The Others. And for more from us, visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to us wherever you listen. All of our episodes are available for free, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 lists of the best American films ever made, and hundreds more titles on top of that. What are we at? You said 411? This is our episode 411. That's a lot of movies.
411.
Your favorite movie? Is probably on there at this point. In exchange for all this great content, perhaps you could leave us a rating and review. And if your favorite movie hasn't been covered by us, and you mention that in a review that you write for us on Apple Podcasts, we will very seriously consider covering it. It also helps people find us, and that is just a kindness that you do because we're so great. We're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can also reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code top100project, and that's all one word, top100project. It's not case sensitive, and that will get you a 20% discount off your next order.
Two things before we wrap up here. Roger Jackson, full marks for that voice. They may be digitally altering it a little bit, but he was excellent in all these movies as the phone voice. And when you see or hear Billy and Stu use the voice box, yeah, they sound enough like him, but it isn't the same voice, literally. So credit to that guy to sound like that, because he's ideal for this. And also W. Earl Brown as Kenny. The movie doesn't make it clear at all that he's fat. Not even a little bit.
It was the 90s. The worst offender thing that they do that is really cringy now is...
He's eating again. And it's fitting, of course, that a woman who's probably 48 pounds is the one who's criticizing for it. Move your fat ass.
Well, Courtney Cox isn't even that fat.
No, he's really not that fat by any standards. Courtney Cox does play a pretty good jerk.
Yes.
In this movie. As for the wrap up, I always had a thing for you, Bev.
And cut.